everybody. Welcome. I'm Tina Cassidy. I'm the Chief Marketing Officer at GBH. We are your public media partner here today. I'm also a former journalist and an author myself. I am so excited to be here with Max. A little bit about Max. I'm sure you all know who he is. That's why you're here. But in case you brought a friend, Max's informative, engaging, and hilarious YouTube channel started during the pandemic, and each episode explores a recipe from history. Whether exploring the dining preferences of Druids, pizza in Pompeii, or a venison recipe enjoyed by Robin Hood, the recipes are well-researched and authentic, sourced from historians' accounts, newspapers, and even poetry and song. His runaway YouTube hit is now a cookbook, Tasting History, Explore the Past Through 4,000 Years of Recipes. So thank you so much for being here with us today, Max.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so we have lots of questions. Let's get right into it. So your YouTube channel, Tasting History, is a huge hit with nearly 2 million subscribers. And for those who haven't seen it, tell us more about how you got it started.
Yeah, so first of all, I apologize if I cough or clear my throat. I've been having issues, so apologies ahead of time. So the show, what was the question? I'm obviously focused on my throat.
How did your YouTube channel get started?
Oh, so it started actually, technically right before the pandemic. I was just looking for a way to be creative. I was working at Disney for the movie studio and not in a particularly creative part of the company. It was a lot of fun, but I was looking for something to do that was kind of my own thing. And I would always bring in food, baked goods to work and share them with my colleagues, but if they wanted to eat the Sally Lunn, they had to first listen to a lecture about the Sally Lunn. And and one of my colleagues said, hey, you should put this on YouTube. Stop telling us. Go tell someone else. And so I spent like all of January 2023, or 2020, like figuring out how to do a YouTube channel and putting together things. And so I put it out at the very end of February. And 2 weeks after that, we were sent home. So I had nothing else to do but work on this.
Well, that's amazing. It's almost everyone had a pandemic project, right? So this was yours. At what point did you realize that you'd really struck a nerve with an audience?
Garum.
Say more.
Yeah, so it was in June. I was actually at my parents' house. My parents are here. I was at my parents' house, and that week I had put out a video making quick garum and talking about this ancient Roman fish sauce. And it had done fine. It had done just like every other episode, and which at the time I thought was actually really great. And then 5 days after it came out, Jose, like, looked at his phone and said, something's wrong with YouTube.
Jose's your husband.
Yes, Jose's my husband. And unfortunately, he couldn't be here today. Overnight, we had gotten, like, 20,000 subscribers and 100,000 views. And then that whole week, it just went crazy, and we hit 100,000 subscribers, and I was like, oh.
Do you know?
There are other nerds out there.
Giving new meaning to secret sauce, I
guess. Exactly, yes.
So like, what was it about garum? Do you know?
I don't know. Yeah. I've been trying to, I mean, honestly, I try to always guess. I'm like, oh, people are going to like this episode, and then nobody watches it. And then sometimes I'm like, oh, I just need to get something out, throw that against the wall. And then it's like, oh, people love this. I mean, Boston Brown Bread, that was one. I was like, most people aren't going to be interested in this. I don't know why. And then people just loved the dish and the history of the Boston molasses flood. So I can never tell. And so I've stopped trying to tell, and I just make episodes that intrigue me. I'm my only audience at this point.
All right. So, but before we move on from garum, what does that taste like?
So, that garum was extremely salty and had a bit of a fishy flavor because I was still living in a tiny condo during lockdown, so I wasn't going to make the true fermented garum because it takes months and it smells really, really right. potent. So I made this quick garum, which is an actual historic recipe from the Byzantine Empire. And so it adds saltiness to a dish. True garum adds saltiness, but also this really intense umami flavor.
Right.
And that is coming because I have made that, because now I have a backyard. And so in November, I'll be doing a true garum episode.
That's awesome. Okay, so your journey from YouTuber to author reminds me a lot of Julie Powell's journey, and who blogged back in 2005 about doing recipes, Julia Child's recipes,
right.
which became a book, Julie and Julia, and then, of course, a film with Meryl Streep. But it's just interesting that that was almost 20 years ago, and it seemed like such a new concept that you could go from blogger to author, and now here we are, and it's sort of YouTuber to author, which feels like a whole new frontier. Tell us what that was like.
I had an editor approach me months after I started the channel. It was a few months after Garum, I guess, and they watched the channel and they said, you know, we'd love you to write a book, but the process takes forever, and so, you know, it didn't come out just now. I started working on it back then. But part of the big challenge was, on my side, figuring out how to take what I do on the channel and put that just on the page. And whether I was successful at that, I'm not entirely sure, because it's very hard to convey, you know, my delivery of something in writing if you aren't a trained writer. And on the other end, that editor who approached me, who loved the channel and loved everything that I was doing, well, she got laid off. And so I ended up going with an editor who didn't know the channel at all. And so there were some growing pains of, this is a history book with recipes. This is not a cookbook.
Right.
It is a cookbook, but it's a history book with recipes. So there was a lot of, you know,
conversations about genre.
Where to
put it.
You know, you don't need to put any of the history stuff in, just the recipes. People don't want that. And I was like, I think they do. See? And I was right. I was right. So it ended up working out well, and we, you know, but there were definitely some challenges just all around, just figuring out what I wanted in the book and what recipes to take, and trying to do this while still putting out videos, because the videos were the number one thing and they take all of my time. So doing anything additional means less sleep, and I love sleep.
Right, right. Don't we all? So how did you edit the recipes or the segments in the stories in your head? Was it based on what was popular on YouTube? Was that sort of the first filter? Or did you want to take the book recipes in a different direction?
Honestly, it was mostly what I had already done. And so I had only done, you know, at that point that I was really working on the book, and I had only done like 50 episodes, right. And they wanted 65 recipes. So it was kind of like, well, everything's making it in. there were really only a few things that didn't in those from those early episodes. Later on, while we were kind of finessing and doing the editing, we were able to be like, we have a lot of stuff from this part of the world and nothing from this, so let's try to add something here, or boy, you really like desserts, maybe put a savory dish in this book. So there was more finesse later on, but that was really at the urging of the editor and my co-writer, Anne Folkvine, because coming up with a recipe and writing a recipe down for someone else to replicate are two totally different skill sets, and I don't have that second skill set. So I worked with someone who was able to take my recipes and put them in a way that other people would be able to replicate.
Okay. So backing up a little bit, how do you decide overall how to come up with a recipe or a story? Is there a dish that you eat, that you love, that you get curious about? Or are you constantly combing ancient texts looking for unusual stories?
Yes, to both of those things. It's because it comes from everywhere. Every episode comes from a slightly different place. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it is a food that I, you know, came across that I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Let's see if there's a history about it.
Right.
And then there is. Mm-hmm. If there's not, then I don't do the episode because there has to be something for me to talk about for 10 minutes.
Right.
But a lot of times it is the story that comes first. And so, you know, this last week's episode was on ancient Roman Olympics, ancient Greek Olympics and what they would have eaten. And there are lots of writings that I found about the foods that they ate and how they trained and their diet. And I was like, fantastic. Now I need to go back and find a recipe that I can do in order to talk about what I want to talk about. And that actually, I feel, happens more often than not. And so luckily, there happened to be a recipe that I was able to kind of shoehorn in. Sometimes it's a little harder than others, because not every food has an interesting story. Most
right.
don't.
Right.
Or at least we don't know them. And so it goes both ways.
Yeah. It seems like you have a particular fascination with ancient food, the ancient world, and in fact, your book is organized not just geographically, but also with an overlay of time, like the ancient world and the new world and so forth, which is really interesting. But I wanted to ask, you know, given your interest in the ancient world, where like the foods seem even weirder, but if we were to like zoom ahead 100 years, people might look back on Jell-O, for example, and think that was really weird too.
I don't think we have to go ahead 100 years.
Right. Fair point. Do you think you would? Are you interested in more like postmodern food stories, or you know, things that are food trends that are happening today that might have a story as well?
Sometimes, yeah. I definitely, just because I love history so much, mm-hmm. it's almost like the further back I go, the more interested I am to some degree. But I do love when I find a trend that's happening now that's like, oh, it's so new. And it's like, no, it ain't. Hey, we're doing this back in the Victorian age. Or, you know, I mean, the gelatin molds of the 50s. It's like, oh, that's so crazy. It was popular in the 1850s.
Was it really?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of my favorite things is going to old antique shops and finding the old Jell-O molds from the Victorian age that were just so ornate and elaborate. And because it took a lot of money and a lot of time to make those, so it was a way to show off your wealth. You know, you probably had cooks making this for you. I don't think the macaroni gelatin rings of 1955 were a way to show off your wealth.
Right.
But it was a way to show off your homemaking skills and, you know, making this beautiful food, even if it might not taste
great. What was it called in the Victorian times? Aspic? Or?
They had aspics, and then they had a lot of them were just called jellies.
Okay.
It kind of depended on, is this something that's savory? Is this something that's sweet?
Yep.
But yeah, nothing's new.
That's kind of true, isn't it?
It really is.
Yeah. So there's all kinds of fascinating recipes, and I feel like you're so good at putting your finger on something that is a food that people have heard of but have no idea what it's about, what it might taste like. It's not part of our diet today, like hardtack, for example.
I can't not, you know?
I mean, anyone who loves a good seafaring book has read about hardtack, right? But you just think, how do you not break your teeth? What do? You have to soak it,
right.
Eat it. But do you also taste your own recipes?
Always.
Yeah, everyone. So you recipe test everything that went in your book.
So I usually don't taste it until the end of the episode.
Okay.
So everything from the show, usually when I'm tasting it on screen, that's the first time that I'm tasting it, with a few exceptions, namely if it's like something that has to be eaten right out of the oven or right. something like that.
Good thing hardtack you could keep hard around tack, forever.
Yeah, yeah. when it comes to the cookbook mm-hmm. recipes, those have been tested over and over and over again by myself and by my Patreon patrons. One of the things that we would do was they would, I would give them the recipe and then have like 30 people make it and then get their feedback so then they could, so that I could kind of hone the recipe around different, you know, people were at different levels of baking experience right. and everything. So it was fantastic.
That's such a cool new way to recipe test. You know, we've come a long way from Julia Child's days of doing recipe testing,
yes.
right? So that's great. And that crowdsourcing is really helpful.
Yeah.
Share some examples of perhaps mistakes you may have made in a recipe that your Patreon fans have given you feedback on.
I mean, a lot of times it comes down to, and this is why I started working with Anne, what are you talking about? You know, when you read, because I wouldn't tell them, I would only write it out.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've ever tried to explain how to form a pretzel using only words, it's very difficult.
Yeah.
And even telling somebody how to blind bake something,
right.
or, you know, they're just not, or you assume that people have a certain level of knowledge,
right.
and they don't, and so you leave something out, being like, "Well, of course they're gonna butter the pan. Who wouldn't butter the pan?" And then they're like, "All my cake's stuck." And it's like, "Ah, okay."
Yeah, right.
Preheat the oven.
Yeah.
By the time it was preheated and making a souffle, it was completely, you know, deflated or whatever.
Love that. Well, so you've got weird recipes like hardtack, but then you also have delicious recipes for things like tamales or lasagna, some of my favorites. Are the recipes you share ones that you would normally cook? Some of the recipes, like those, things that you would normally eat at home? Or are you, again, just trying to look for the story there? No.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you eat at home?
No. We order Thai a lot. There are very few things that I've made multiple times just because I liked it. I've made a syllabub a few times because it is very good and it's very easy.
Tell us what that is and what it tastes like.
It's whipped cream with alcohol.
Okay.
And it tastes like whatever you put into it. So the one that I have is has some orange water, but you can do it with rose or all sorts of things, all sorts of flavors. The pecan pie I make now pretty much for every holiday, so because it is just a better version of pecan pie. And I think that I'm going to end up making, so there's a new pumpkin pie recipe that'll be coming out on Halloween, and I'll probably end up making that a few times.
That sounds delicious.
Yeah.
Well, it does sound like dessert is your thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, honestly, if the show had, if you go back and watch the very first episodes, it's clear that it was supposed to only be medieval baking. Because all of the first, like, five or six episodes, it's medieval baking. And then it was like, oh, well, this is going to be a very short show.
Yes. Well, but there's medieval baking, and then there's medieval baking. So I wrote a book about the history of childbirth. So when I saw placenta on your book index, I was like, okay, people do eat placenta.
They do.
But that's not the placenta index recipe that you have. Tell us about what that is.
So this is, it's a layered cake from ancient Rome with tracta, which is basically like really hard pasta, and then cheese and honey. And it is what gave placenta its name.
Right.
Because somebody thought that that looked like a cake.
Maybe with some jelly on it.
Yeah, I don't know. But yes, yeah, so totally, totally different. But what's interesting is I was just in Greece, and they still have a dish that is very, very similar to it, which I really thought was interesting that it hasn't changed.
So interesting.
Yeah.
Well, the book is also beautifully photographed. You talked about that process of going from, you know, being in your kitchen making YouTube videos to becoming an author with an editor and so forth. So how you transform the visual aspect onto the printed page. And it really has, the photography in it is it's very well done, the way you mix pictures with historical sort of artifacts and also your own narration. Tell us about how that all came together. I mean, were you working with a food stylist? Were you in your own kitchen? How did that come to be?
So anyone who watches the show knows that those photos are not my photos. I can't figure out my lighting even for, like, just lighting me every episode. It's so inconsistent. So I worked with a professional food photographer and everything, and a stylist, which was amazing. But we worked together. They had never done anything that was, like, historical. Everything was very, very modern, everything that they had photographed. And I was like, I want to evoke the period without it being, like, costumey.
Right.
You know? And so there was a lot of... It was really cool because I told that to the food stylist, and she said, okay, I'm going to go shopping, and then you can see what I got, and we'll go from there. And that next week, I met with them, and they had an entire... They rented out an Airbnb because my condo was too small to take pictures in. And, like, two entire rooms were just filled with pewter plates and mugs and just, like, everything that I want for the show that they had rented. I didn't get any of it. I did get one mug, I think. But it was just so cool, and I was like, you get what I'm going for, you know? Yeah. It was like certain aspects of the photos are historical, but it's all still very, you know, belongs in a modern cookbook.
Definitely.
That was my favorite part of the whole process.
Well, I have
seen
you...
Because I didn't have to do anything.
Sure. But the dress-up part is cool, too. I have seen you in pictures dressed as Prince Charming,
yes.
Right? Yes. Yes. So that's a... Disney costume part comes
when I work for Disney Cruise Line.
There you go.
It's charming. And I just got a Napoleon hat because I'm going as Napoleon for Halloween, and I'm very excited to wear that because I'm also doing an episode on Napoleon.
Oh,
so
cool.
You'll see me in my Napoleon hat. For what I spent on that hat, I'm getting a lot of mileage out of it.
What did Napoleon like to eat?
You'll have to watch.
All right. All right. So when we were chatting before this session, you were saying you just got back from Europe where you were doing a lot of research. Like, how do you map that out? You think, oh, I'm going to pick a country and go deep, or is there some idea that sparks your journey?
It was more that we picked a country. It actually started off, some friends of mine who were all turning 40 this year, we decided we wanted to go to Greece for our 40th, nice. And I was like, oh, tax write-off if I can make this a research trip. So I'm going to add a little bit more time and do, like, just deep dive into some history. I ended up also adding on Vienna
okay.
to it because it was a layover that I made 3 days long. but it was fantastic because I kind of knew some dishes that I wanted to do some research on. Like in Vienna, the Sachertort, the Wiener Schnitzel and stuff. But then there were a lot of things when I got there that I had never come across before. And so they were like, oh, there are stories behind this. Or this has nothing to do with food, but wow, what an interesting story. I can make this have something to do with food somehow. So we'll be seeing some Habsburg episodes coming up. But it ended up being a very research intensive trip, but I kind of was able to go in, especially in Greece, with nothing planned. It was everything that I came across inspired me to do an episode. We went to Asclepius, who was he's the guy with the snake on the cane, you know, the healer, and we went to one of his temples, and they had all of these ancient stones and everything, and I don't read ancient Greek. So if I had just gone there, it would have been a really cool thing to see. But I had a guide who did read ancient Greek, and we were walking around, and she's like, oh, you might be interested in this one. This was written by someone who came here to be healed, and basically they put this up as an advertisement. Mm-hmm. And it said, I had so-and-so or whatever wrong with me, and I came here, and they prescribed me a diet of this and this, and it was cooked this way, and I drank this, and now I got better. You should do that. And it's like, Well, that's an episode right there.
Definitely.
That happened every single day, every single place that I went. I was like, oh, yes, there's an episode right there. Mm-hmm. So I'm never going to run out of ideas if I keep traveling, I think.
Definitely not. What was your favorite meal in Greece?
I think my favorite meal was, it was a part of a meal. It was, we went to a food festival that we didn't know was happening on a tiny little island that you couldn't get to unless you were on like a private boat.
Okay.
And so there weren't that many tourists there. So it was everybody who was kind of local. And so they had foods that they don't usually give to tourists. And so, you know, spanikopita, which is like a spinach pie, that's what I thought it was. It was not. It was a cake that was made with spinach and cinnamon and cardamom and nutmeg. And it reminded me a lot of the flavors of Skopje's herb tort, because it was that from, you know, the Renaissance was made with those kind of sweet flavors and spinach. And it's like, they're still making that here. And that was one of my favorite things because it was so different.
That's amazing. It sounds delicious. Good thing lunch is coming up next.
Yes. Spinach cake for everyone.
Do you have a, I know, desserts aside, do you have a favorite kind of food, like international flavors or ethnicity?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of whatever I'm eating at the time. But I think Italian food, just in general, we had a wonderful Italian meal last night in the North End. I just, all the flavor, it's, you know, it's so good. And then Thai food. I love Thai food.
Yeah.
But at almost everything. There are very few cuisines that I don't like. Mexican, I mean, we eat Mexican food all the time growing up in Arizona. So... not very many Mexican food restaurants here in Boston, it turns out. That's okay, but...
we have good Mexican food.
I'm sure.
Yeah, we do.
We just haven't found it, I guess. But I like everything. Cuisine-wise, there are certain foods I don't like.
Like what?
Mushrooms.
Okay, but why not? Can you talk
it's
about that?
It's the texture.
All right.
Because I like the flavor. Like, I love if you make, like, a beef Wellington... has mushroom in it, but it's so ground up so fine that you're just getting the flavor, fantastic. But the texture, it's a thing for me. It's the same thing with liver, I guess.
Yes, no comment on the liver. I was chatting with your parents before the session and your mom...
Don't believe a word they say.
Well, your mom was an English teacher
yes.
for decades, so clearly some of the word stuff has rubbed off on you. But I'm curious, you know, you worked in marketing at Disney, right? And so, and now you've written a book. Just, it's an interesting mix of skills to be able to tell a good story, be able to do research, make it visual and appealing, and obviously be popular, right? Tell us about, you know, elements of your upbringing that are helping to make you successful today.
So my mom's a big part, and it's not just that she was an English teacher, she was also a humanities teacher. And so she would, in her class, she would teach history and architecture and literature and art and everything all at once. Mm. And so it was taking from all these different places and kind of putting it into one lesson plan.
Right.
And that's kind of what I do with food and history, right. You know, kind of bring it together. And it makes it go down a lot easier, literally and figuratively. But right. So, I mean, everybody, I actually took my mom's class because I went to school where she taught, and everybody, that was their favorite class because it is such a wonderful way to learn. My grandfather used to tell me stories of, you know, World War II and the Depression and everything, and the way that he would tell them, just even to a little kid, it was just so exciting. He had a wonderful way of just putting stuff very matter-of-factly. He was from Missouri, you know, it was just no frills.
Right.
But so I was able to put myself in his shoes, and so that's kind of what got me into history, was just being able to put myself in the shoes of these historical figures, or in the Napoleon hat of these historical figures, if you will. And then when it comes to, you know, I did theater for a very long time, and so you learn storytelling, whether you are trying to or not. And then I spent, while I was working for Disney, like I said, I was trying to do something creative, and Tasting History was the last thing that I tried. But I had many things before that that didn't work out.
What were those?
I tried doing animation, tried writing a novel. Did write a novel, it just, you know, didn't go anywhere. But in doing that, I learned about storytelling, and I learned about, you know, how to write to a degree. So I think that just all of the, I'm not going to say failures, all of the things that didn't go the way that I had planned ended up kind of coming together to go out well beyond what I had planned, you know, because I did not think that this would be the one to take off.
Isn't that funny how, you know, life just kind of takes over and you end up in a place that you hadn't expected?
Yeah.
Well, your food YouTube channel is incredibly successful, and your book is as well. You know, do you see yourself continuing on with telling stories about the history of food? Like, is that your, who you are going to be, or do you have other things that you're interested in exploring in the future?
Yes and more. I have no plans on stopping what I'm doing, but I do have plans on doing more. Mainly, there's a lot of history that I want to tell that isn't food history, and that even I can't shoehorn into an episode on food history. And so I'm looking for
a way to
tell that.
Yeah.
Oh, just, you know, the Peloponnesian War.
Right.
Just so many stories from that in general that I'm like, oh, I want to talk about this. It just doesn't fit. Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, literally anything from history. I'm interested in everything from history. And so having to only talk about, you know, these certain things, it's always like, oh, but people would be so interested in this.
Yeah.
And so I'm figuring out a way to tell some of those stories.
And would that take the form of another YouTube channel?
It'll probably be a podcast / another YouTube channel that will be coming hopefully very soon.
Oh, cool. That's exciting.
The problem is figuring out a way to do it that it's less work.
Right.
Because I literally can't do any more
than
I, you know, the editing and the images and everything, it just takes up so much time. So I'm trying to figure out a way to tell the stories without quite as much production. And so hopefully people will.
Yeah, I mean, you make it look so easy, right? I mean, there's like a 10-minute video, and you're cooking a recipe and telling a story, but there's, how many hours goes into that one episode?
Each episode is between 35 and 50 hours, I would say.
That's a lot.
They usually tend to be on the more 50, because my episodes used to be 10 minutes. Now they're like 20 minutes. Just the history section alone is usually over 10 minutes. And yeah, so the research is the most, you know, takes the longest, and then writing it, and then working on the recipe, and filming the food, and then filming myself, and then the editing.
And partly you do all of that yourself?
Until recently, I did all of it by myself. I just started working with someone who is helping me with the editing. Yeah. She takes about the first half of the editing, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's a lot.
So can we just geek out a little bit on research?
Yeah.
So obviously, you know, what is available online today through, you know, digitized archives is pretty spectacular, access to libraries all over the globe. But you're going back really far for some of your work. Research is its own skill. Right? Tell us about how you go down these rabbit holes. Sometimes you, as a historical researcher, you'll hit a wall. How do you fill in those holes? Like, bring us into that world for a moment.
Yeah, so, I mean, I couldn't have done this 15 years ago.
Right.
Literally would have been impossible.
Yeah.
Because I go to all sorts of different libraries and museums worldwide from my desk.
Right.
And you can see old cookbooks and old, you know, documents and paintings and everything. So I usually start, if I have an idea, then there's that. But if I don't, then I just go to one of my many, many books on the, physical books on the wall, and I just start flipping through. And each one of them probably has 20 or 30 little pieces of paper that have been stuck in there previously that say, hey, come back to me. And so sometimes I'll just pull out one of those and be like, oh, yes, that's why I was interested in that. and then the research, you know, so I might have a book on the topic or have some base knowledge, but a lot of times it starts with a Google search or going to Wikipedia, because Wikipedia is just the very surface, but at the bottom of a Wikipedia page, there's a bibliography. Mm-hmm. And you can go to those sources, and then those sources usually have links to actual old newspaper articles or, you know, old documents in those primary sources and everything. And so it takes time and patience, but eventually you can get to the good stuff. But a lot of times, I don't want to say more often than not, but I'd say probably 30% of the time, after a couple hours, I'll realize there's no there there. There's not enough to talk about. It's not that interesting. Most food is just not that interesting. Historical, you know, the stories. And so the nice thing is, in that 2 hours that I've been researching, there's always something that I've been like, oh, but that might be interesting. Oh, but that's a cool story. And so then I'll just go down one of those tangents instead. Rare is it that I try not to be like, I am doing an episode on this topic, because invariably, it won't work.
Yeah. It feels like a lot of pressure to have to come up with, you know, a story as regularly as you do. But it sounds like you're sort of keeping lists and ideas as you're working, and you always have something generating in the background.
Yeah, and you know, I think it goes for all people who do writing. The blank page is just every week. I'm like, this is it. I have no more ideas. This is goodbye, cruel world. And then I literally write down. I'll usually, the first thing that I write down on the page is time for history. And because that is usually about a third of the way through the episode. And so I'll put like opening, recipe, time for history. Okay, now I've got to find something. But just having that on there, I'm like, oh, well, half the episode's done. Great. and then it's like, so it's all mental. I'm always able, because I do have so many stories in the back of my head, and and they come from all over.
Yeah.
You know, and now that people know that I'm interested in this, I get emails and letters and Facebook messages and Instagram messages every single day with, hey, there's something interesting I found out, or hey, I was down at a battleship in Long Beach and they had a menu from the Thanksgiving dinner in 1943 on the wall. You should do a video on that. Well, guess what? So, as long as people keep messaging me, I'll have ideas.
That's great. Do you think you'll write another book? And if so, will it also be about this subject?
So, we actually had drinks with Anne, who was my co-author, and I'm going to say yes, I think I'll write another book. Yes, it will somewhat be on this same topic. It's going to be a little bit different. When I do it is another thing.
It is very time-consuming, for sure.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. And like I said, I mean, I want to do a podcast. I want to do this, and I want to travel more, and I want to do all these things. So it's like, all right, get in the back of the line.
Right, for sure. Well, maybe we can open it up to questions from the audience at this point. There is a microphone right here, and if you could just, I guess we could shout it out, too, see if that works. I see you with
your
hand
up. It's not that big of
a room. Yeah, let's try. Go for it.
Yeah. So I think my favorite thing so far that I've covered about Boston's history is the molasses flood, just because it's so weird. And it seems like something that is easily mockable from 100 years distance. And then you start researching and it's like, oh my God, no, this is a tragedy. And I think that we do that too often. Once you get honestly, Salem in general, I had that same kind of feeling. It's like, oh, you know, witchy stuff. Oh, and then you're there and it's like, people, do you know what happened here? And it's like, it really, so when you start to learn the history, I think it just kind of, it grounds you more. Things that I want to cover, though, I want to cover something about the Salem witch trials. I know it's not Boston, but I do. And something about the U.S.'s Constitution, because just being on that boat was freaking cool.
Hello there.
Hello.
This is, I guess I also kind of have a two-pronged one. The first about recipes for that you might be doing, just the first one is, are there any recipes that you really love to have done? History was great, but there just wasn't enough information there to really reconstruct what the recipe was. And the second part, are there any recipes you'd really like to make, kind of like, I guess the best comparison would be that fish pudding one, just to try and figure out what in the heck they were thinking?
I think to the first part, there are, that's most recipes, historic recipes, because we just have a name. You know, I ate this. Well, what was this? You don't explain at all what it is. There's actually an ancient Greek recipe that has like the longest name in the world. I believe it is the longest word that's ever been written. It's something like 64 letters long, but we don't really know what it is. And I'm like, I want to make that just because I can try to pronounce it, but I don't know what it is. So that's one of them, but it's a lot of things. things that I want to try simply because I want to figure out what they meant. Honestly, there are so many things to make that anything where I'm like, eh, I'm going to not make it usually, unless I think the history is interesting. And then I'm like, I'm putting myself through this because it's worth the story.
All right. Thank you.
Hi.
Hi.
So one of my favorite things that you've done has been the Titanic episodes.
Thank you.
I think, like, it's kind of like, I hate to use this, but like the Miller Cinematic Universe kind of.
I love that. That's fantastic.
So, like, suddenly, instead of just a one-off episode, it was a series of episodes over the course of, I think it might have been like a month or something. And it just really guided us through this world and different parts of that world as you illustrated the different kinds of cuisines and who ate what. Actually, my friends are going to try to do like a potluck where we do the whole second class cuisine.
Oh, very nice.
Together.
Love it.
But so my question is, are there other concepts or other topics for which you want to do some sort of a series like that?
So there are. It's hard. One, because I have a strange fascination with the Titanic, so it wasn't hard for me to spend an entire month researching it. Whereas usually, after like 4 days, I get bored and I want to move on to something else. So I don't know if I'm going to. There are, like, I did an entire month on Roman cuisine a couple years back, but it's hard to tell a story on YouTube that is like that, because it's hard to get everyone to watch in that way, because that's not how YouTube works. It's kind of a per episode thing. And it's not necessarily the viewer's issue, it's the way that YouTube offers up videos. And so, you know, if you look at a lot of the comments, they're like watching a first class episode, and it's like, I wish you would do something from the third class. Well, that was the first episode, but they didn't see it. And you can't blame them for not seeing it. So it's hard to tell that kind of story over multiple episodes. It's not to say that I won't, because I do kind of have some ideas. One of them actually is to tell all of the what was eaten on the home front during World War II, but by country. All of, like, so I would, all right, maybe this is happening. So it would be America and, you know, and England and France, but also Italy and Japan and Germany and Russia. And because they're all fascinating and they all had people on the home front who really didn't want to be doing what was going on. Some of the most interesting recipes actually come from Germany in 1945 because they didn't have nothing left. Mm. And so I think it would be that would be cool. But getting it to be watched, not easy. But after that, it's probably going to happen. So. Yes.
Hi.
Sorry.
Sorry. Can I go? Or? Sorry.
Can we just get one in?
Yeah.
Go ahead. So you briefly mentioned you can't read ancient Greek.
I cannot.
Have you felt that there have been language barriers that have prevented you from reading episodes? Or during your research, how do you get around those language barriers?
Language barriers. Yeah. So I don't speak most languages, obviously. and many times it is difficult. Now, with ancient Greek, it's extremely difficult. But with most modern languages, at least I have Google Translate so that I can put something into Google Translate to figure out, is this even about food? Is this even about, like, what is this about? And then I can have somebody who does read the language translate it. But the older the language is, like, I have someone who knows how to translate 18th century Chinese, Mandarin, because it's very, very different from modern. But I don't have that person for everything, you know, so it does get hard, but I just move on to another episode when that happens. Yes, sorry about
that. Sorry for interrupting.
No, you're good.
I just want to say I've been a huge fan, and you're an inspiration for me and projects that I want to do in the future.
Thank you.
And I'm just wondering, what has been the most difficult aspect of running the channel or, you know, even just doing the book, for you? What's been challenging?
It's two things. One is the not having it become 24 hours of my life. It kind of is. It's all that I think about usually, but I am trying to, you know, travel more. And yes, it's a tasting history trip, but at least I'm getting out of the house. Because a lot of times I won't. The other thing is negative comments. I don't get that many, but even one can ruin my week, so I don't. After the first couple days, Jose reads the comments and hides the ones that I... yeah. I don't do well with negativity. He keeps me safe. It's a safe space. Thank you for the question.
Hello.
Hi.
This question is not about food or history, but about your set dressings. How many Pokemon plushies do you have in your house?
I think we're past 400 now. But there are like 1,000 available, so... And the part of the problem is they don't all exist as plushies, so that is one of the things. But also, they're not mine. They're all Jose's. And how they ended up getting into the episodes was quite by accident. There was one behind me that was actually from Animal Crossing. It wasn't a Pokemon. In the very first video, or second video, and I didn't notice it while I was filming. And it was like, well, I'm not going to refilm because I'm lazy. So he's just back there. And then Jose started swapping him out every time I would film. It wasn't until like the 10th episode that I realized what was going on. And now they're just as popular as I am on that set.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for brightening me and my fiance's Tuesday evenings, for one.
Glad to do.
I wanted to ask you about your research process while you are traveling, how you keep a balance between research and immersing yourself in the culture, whatever you're exploring there, especially since you mentioned your recent 3-day layover being so intensive. And if you feel like indulging another two-prong question, what's another bucket list travel location for you?
Even though I went there when I was a kid, Japan, because you don't get to really enjoy it the same way when you're 12 as you would now. So Japan is one of them, as is Iceland. But the first part of your question, which I'm trying to remember, which was?
So balancing research and...
Oh, yes.
Isn't like a judicious use
yes.
of the notes?
So, no, the nice thing is I have a terrible memory for names and obviously questions, but I have a fantastic memory for history. And if you tell me something, or if I read something, I will remember it for at least a while. So I don't usually have to take notes, and so I can be immersed in something, and that is the research. And then I'm always of the mind, I can find it online later, because I can, almost always. So I'm like, even if I don't remember exactly what it was this person told me, I'm like, I know enough to I can go look it up. I would rather be in the moment and get inspired to do episodes rather than like taking judicious notes.
Of course, it's the benefit of travel. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hello.
What's the most complicated dish you've ever made, and has there ever been one so complicated you just gave up even trying on it?
Yes, and yes. I think the most complicated dish that I've made so far, there are probably a few, but one of them was the castle pie that I made last May.
Oh, yeah.
Never again. there are many cakes by Antoine Crème, which are just massive pieces of art that I don't have the skill to do.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I have two questions. One is, do you ever cook for your cats? And the second one is, do you have any Asian culture food you would like to make that you haven't made before?
What was the first part?
How were your cats? I mean, do you cook for your cats? Sorry.
So unfortunately, Jamie passed away recently, which still not over. Cersei is fantastic. Do I cook for them? Cersei wouldn't eat anything that I cooked. So not. Jamie ate everything that I cooked. The trick was getting him to not eat the food. And the Asian culture, I mean, there's so much. Part of the issue doing Asian episodes is the translation issue, because there's so little that's actually been translated into English. And I can't even Google Translate that, because I don't know how to type Thai, you know? And so it does make it much more difficult to do those episodes, but there's so much food that I do want to cover, so it's just a matter of doing them.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Hey.
Hi.
First of all, welcome to Boston. Thanks for keeping the rain away.
Thank you.
It's so evident that you put a lot of effort into your accents. I was wondering if that's something that was always easy for you, or if you took it on for the show, and what's been the most difficult accent?
So I think I don't want to say it's always been easy for me, but it's always been something that I've done well, as my parents can attest to. And then I was a vocal performance or classical music singer for a long time, so I had to take classes literally just in pronunciation. Didn't know what I was saying, you just had to say it right. And so that helped, and I learned IPA, the phonetic alphabet. The hardest, I think, Icelandic is definitely one of the hardest that I've done. Thai is also very difficult.
Thank you.
Now it all makes sense. Okay.
Hey, Max.
Hi.
So obviously, with all of the history you do lots of spices. And I think all of our ancestors would be very excited to see our spice cabinets now and think we're rich.
Yeah.
What is your favorite spice?
Cardamom. Or vanilla. Cardamom and vanilla. In the same dish.
So you've talked a little bit about some of your favorite recipes, like the syllabub, for example, or the Sally Lund buns. I'm curious, is there a particular period of history that you really like researching, or history from a certain part of the world?
So my favorite period of history is today, 957 years ago. Today is the Battle of Hastings, October 14th. So the Battle of Hastings and the 10 to 15 years before it and the 10 years after it, that's my favorite period of history, England during that transition. But in general, I love medieval history. I also love the Regency period, because if I had to live during a period, if I was rich, it would be during the Regency period. So yeah, I love, those are two periods that I love. But honestly, I love whatever I'm reading about at the time. I like, you know, just put it in front of me and it's like, oh, this is the most interesting thing that I've ever read.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi. So over time, there's definitely been a trend towards longer episodes. I was wondering if you've ever considered doing perhaps even longer ones where you...
I thought you were going to say shorter episodes. Get to the point.
Where you could perhaps explore more deeply into a topic or into a larger topic and perhaps do more than one recipe.
So that's kind of my idea. The history aspect, that's what I want to do with the podcast, is that I can do that. So for each minute of an episode, it's 2 hours of time. So I like the Titanic video that I did this spring, I think was like 28 minutes. That took me so long, and I vowed never again, because it becomes so much more every additional minute. Just the editing takes longer, the research takes longer, everything does. So probably not too much longer on Tasting History, but I want other ways to go more in-depth to this with the stories that don't require so much editing, and I think the podcast is going to be the way to do that. But there are ways that I could do on Tasting History that is more cooking, because the cooking actually doesn't take as much time as you'd think. So it's just kind of figuring out how to do that. I'm not sure.
Thank you.
Hello, Max. Thank you again for coming to Boston. We're so happy to have you here in the Northeast. I have a really quick two-part question. First is, will we have the opportunity after the panel to get our books signed by you?
Yes, and I think it's downstairs.
Yes. And of all the recipes that you have cooked, whether it be because it tasted terrible or was a pain to make, which was your least favorite and why?
It was about a year ago. Still have the taste in my mouth. It was the jellyfish frittata patina from ancient Rome. What was I thinking?
Thank
it's an interesting
you.
Episode, though.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you. Yeah.
So this is kind of a related question, actually. You've talked in multiple videos and today about how food history also often results in really unexpected cuisines. Like you talked about the spinach pie with cinnamon in it. Of all of the recipes that you've done, is there a particular either specific recipe or specific time period that really surprised you with the sort of differences in its cuisine compared to today?
I think the Renaissance, the Italian Renaissance, just that period where you've got some modern ideas of cooking coming in, but you've still got those really old flavors of sweet and savory are not separate. Sugar, cinnamon, meat, and rhubarb and spinach all go in the same dish. Coming together with very modern, the ways that actual dishes are made. Sauces are starting to be thickened with something other than breadcrumbs and things like that. So I think that those flavors are the most, like, interesting, with all, at the same time, something that I recognize. You know, the further back you go, it's like, well, nobody eats these foods anymore in this collection. So it's totally, totally different. But yeah, the Italian Renaissance is an interesting period.
I think this might be our time for our last question, unless we can do a little bit of a speed round and get one or.
I'll be very quick.
Yeah.
I have a couple questions. Question number one. Do you have any intention on doing an episode on the World's Fair?
Not off the top of my mind, but no reason that I wouldn't.
Question number two, what's your favorite Pokemon?
Blastoise.
Yeah. All right, we'll do another.
Okay, on the topic, World War II home front, have you considered doing one on the home front of the U.S. Victory Gardens? There's still one in Fenway.
Yes, that would definitely be a big part of those episodes. Also, I love your shirt.
Okay, last question. Yes.
I'm going to make this really fast. I'm a huge fan. Love history, love food. Your show is the perfect blend. Your episodes have inspired some of my cooking for holidays and D&D nights. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
I am here representing a dedicated fan base at the Boston Tea Party Ships and Museum. We were so excited for you to come there last Saturday. I was like 10 feet away from you, and I was like, oh, I gotta keep it cool, keep it cool. My question is too. Did our history inspire any future episodes, and did you like the teas?
Yes, though I ended up having the grog, so.
Terrific.
It was wonderful visiting.
Well, I know we have a few more people who didn't get questions in, but Max is going to be downstairs signing books, and he'll be there to chat some more with, but I just want...
Can we get them to be at the front?
Yes.
Just so I make sure that...
Sure. I know we have a young person, too, so we'll get you in there. But I just want to say thank you all so much for coming. Max, it was a pleasure.
Thank you all so much. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.